Today marks the launch of the My Perfect Console Patreon. There are all sorts of benefits to becoming a Patreon supporter. You will, for example, receive guest announcements exclusively long before the general public. You will have the opportunity to pitch questions to select future guests and download bonus episodes in which guests answer those questions. You'll have the chance to vote in the My Perfect Console Best Console of the Year knockout competition starting later in 2023, in which you, the listeners, will crown the very best console of the year. Lots more to come too. The exclusive members-only My Perfect Console Community Lounge, where you can meet other listeners. And, of course, at some point, the chance to purchase a mug or a sticker, something like that. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. And get involved.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a French-Moroccan political journalist and author based in London. She grew up in Nantes on the west coast of France, then moved to the UK in 2009 to study journalism at the University of Westminster. After graduating, she freelanced for several broadsheets, then joined the Evening Standard as a political diarist. In 2016, she became the media and politics correspondent for BuzzFeed News, where she broke stories including the UKIP leader Nigel Farage's meeting with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Since leaving BuzzFeed, she has become a prolific freelancer and the author of three books, 2019's Haven't You Heard? A Guide to Westminster Gossip and Why Mischief Gets Things Done, 2021's Honourable Misfits, a brief history of Britain's weirdest, unluckiest and most dangerous MPs, and most recently, Escape, how a generation shaped, destroyed and survived the internet. She's also an eager player of video games and has completed The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild without dying once. Welcome, Marie Leconte.
Hello. That was a very long, my God. It sounded like I was listening to my mother here, but yeah.
Is she a big supporter?
Oh, no, she is. I think the entirety of Morocco is aware of the fact that I have written books now. I don't know if she's managed to work that, you know, with the, like, maybe the national press, the royal family or something. But yeah, I think every single person in Morocco is aware that I'm an author.
Well, I got that last fact about Breath of the Wild. I got that from your Wikipedia, which I read today. And it also states in May 2023, Marie took a day off work to wear her pajamas and play The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. Now, is that noteworthy enough for the world's encyclopedia? And also, where did they get that info?
So this is actually quite a funny story. I got interviewed slightly randomly by the BBC about Tears of the Kingdom coming out, because they were kind of doing a piece on the, you know, Zelda super fans, and I mentioned that, yeah, I'd taken the day off to play. And then, yeah, and because it was a kind of longer chat as well, so we talked about Breath of the Wild, and I did say, so yes, I've done kind of like two runs of that from a fresh file. And the second one, kind of by accident, but I did manage to complete the permadeath challenge. So I did, you know, all four divine beasts and Ganon and over 100 shrines, etc., without dying a single time. And then I kind of tweeted about it and tweeted about how absurd it was for the BBC to have covered that. And then, in basically, what I thought, like, what is absolutely certain was obviously a joke. I said, oh, I can't believe, you know, something along the lines of, I can't believe my Wikipedia has not yet been updated to state that I completed the permadeath challenge. And then, but literally about 20 minutes later, someone replied to say, oh no, it's there now. And I was like, oh, what have I done? And obviously I can't edit my own page, so it's just there. So I'm quite mortified, but we are where we are.
That's wonderful. You have to put that in your blurb on the back of your books from now on, I think. Yeah. So, all right. Well, listen, it's been like quite a busy few years for political journalists in the UK, I'd say. You know, have video games provided much of an escape from all the hecticness of Brexit and Partygate and Liz Truss and all the rest?
Well, so actually, annoyingly, I was not really into video games for most of the kind of political upheaval years. So I kind of started writing about politics full time in 2015.
Yeah.
But actually only really started. So I think, you know, like lots of people, I played lots of games when I was a kid, when I was a kind of like very early teenager, and like with my brother, would play Soul Calibur, would play lots of like Mario games, etc., and all the earlier Zelda games. And then, yeah, about sort of, you know, 13, 14, I discovered alcohol and kissing. And I was like, well, that's a lot better use of my much better use of my time. So I kind of stopped playing games for a very long time. And then what happened is that, so the first lockdown, so I live by myself. And the first lockdown, I went completely mental because I'm normally a very social and very active person. And suddenly I was stuck in a very small flat by myself. So yeah, so a generally really bad time for me. And also because I think I didn't. So I think a lot of people managed to relax into it, but which I did not do at all. So I was doing an hour to 2 hours of exercise every day. I was getting dressed every single day, like during the entire lockdown, even, you know, when I wasn't seeing anyone, obviously.
Like a good, diligent freelancer.
And no, but I think my thing was, if I don't do, sorry, I'm going quite deep quite early on here, but I think I did find it so horrible that I thought, if I don't stick to that very strict routine, I'm going to fall apart entirely and very quickly. So I actually, yeah, again, that was probably the healthiest I'd ever been and the, you know, most organized I'd ever been, etc.
Right, yeah.
And then when the winter lockdown came, I kind of went the opposite direction, really, where I thought, no, I just can't do this twice. So I bought myself my first ever pair of pajamas. I was about to say adult pajamas, but that sounds weirdly sexual, when all I mean is that I'd never bought pajamas as an adult.
Right.
And I bought some, you know, fluffy slippers and a projector to watch movies on. And I bought a Switch. So I went to, this is quite bleak, I went to the CEX in Clapham, which was doing, so you only had to stand outside because you couldn't obviously go into the shop on, I think, the 24th of December, because obviously I couldn't go home for Christmas. And yeah, and so my Christmas present from me to me was a Switch Lite, just kind of secondhand.
Oh, wow.
Because I thought, yeah, I'm just going to be 14 in the second lockdown. That's my plan.
Handed to you by a man in a mask and wearing medical gloves, handing you your Christmas present.
That was basically it. Yeah, it was just, again, incredibly, incredibly bleak. But yeah, no, but it was massive game changer. And I think since the end of the pandemic, a lot of people have talked about, you know, the surprising amounts of silver linings actually the lockdowns had and blah, blah, blah. I would say that for me, there were, you know, 95% horrible. And actually, you know, I hated all of it and all the pandemic and everything in the isolation. But video games were the one thing where I'm like, actually, that did kind of change my life. So I ended up playing, obviously, so the entire winter lockdown, I basically just spent gaming. So I think, what was it, 2021, at the end of the year, you know, Nintendo sends you an email saying how much you've played. And I think it was, but something mad, like 470 hours, I think, in a year, which is just so many hours. But then basically what happened is that after lockdown ended, I just kept playing and I haven't really stopped. But, you know, kind of to the extent that until actually Tears of the Kingdom came out, I'd run out of it. I feel like I've played all the good Switch games. Like, I've completed the Switch. So that's a very, very long way of saying that actually politics had kind of already mostly calmed down by the time I got into gaming.
Very nice. You know, we hear a lot about the so-called Westminster bubble in the UK, the sort of community of MPs and civil servants and journalists and all of that. What does it feel like to be part of that world? But also, I guess, as a French person, sort of maybe with a slight outsider perspective, is it as cloistered and maybe exciting as it seems?
It is kind of weird. So I think it's... And again, like, there's going to be, I realize you don't actually want to make a podcast about the pandemic, but I think it's become relevant again. So I'm mostly, like, that's mostly my experience, I guess, pre-pandemic. So it feels quite parochial, I think, is the thing. So it is like being in a village, because you have about what? So, you know, at most between sort of 4 and 6 pubs, which are the pubs everyone goes to. And obviously you can walk to all of them. And you've got Parliament and you've got the 3 to 5 restaurants everyone goes to. So you kind of bump into everyone all the time. Everyone you meet, you will by definition have at the very least a handful of mutual friends with. If something happens, you'll hear about it again. That gossip travels at an incredible pace, especially, you know, thanks to WhatsApp, etc. But also just again because everyone works in that very small bubble. But, you know, but to the extent when I say it's a very small bubble, it is often really hard to get, say, MPs or, you know, political journalists, you know, kind of people who are even more sort of bubble than I am to go for a drink or for dinner in Soho. For context, for those who are listening who may be, not very familiar with London, it is, like, hand on heart, I think a 20-minute walk from Parliament to Soho. Like, it is up the road. It is so close. And yet if you say to people, can you come to this thing in Soho? They're like, Jesus Christ, like, obviously not. You know, I didn't have my hiking boots. I don't have my snacks and my backpack. So I think the main thing is that, yeah, it feels physically very small. But it's also, I think, and kind of on your point of me having kind of one foot in, one foot out. So I was definitely more, I think, of an insider before the pandemic. And I think you do kind of forget that the rest of the world exists, especially, I think, if you came in quite young, which a lot of people do. So again, I was in my early 20s when I started writing full-time about politics. A lot of people come in as parliamentary assistants or, you know, whatever kind of junior jobs, and same there. They're usually in their early mid-20s, late 20s at the latest. It becomes quite easy to forget the rest of the world exists, but also to just, I don't know, kind of like become obsessed with every little detail, every little piece of gossip, every little, you know, perceived slight from someone, from an acquaintance or from whoever. But again, in the same way that, you know, I grew up in a city, but the sense I get from friends who grew up in villages or in very, very small towns, like, that's kind of what happens, right? Where, you know, because you just always bump into the same people all the time, you do become really insular and really obsessed again with all the stuff that's happening inside. So that's very, very much what it feels like. And again, since I think the pandemic was quite weird for me because I'm a freelancer, I don't actually have a parliamentary pass, so I don't work from Parliament. So the way I used to work was to kind of be the friendly neighborhood stray cat of Westminster, where I would go to, you know, I'd attend the opening of an envelope. I'd go to all the receptions and the parties and any excuse to go to the pub in Westminster, etc. So yeah, when suddenly the pandemic happened, I was a bit like, oh, okay, the bubble has become smaller and it's definitely shut some people out. And I think since then, I've perhaps made less of an effort to get back into the kind of extent I used to be in, but you know, in a way that I've think of as positive, because actually the pandemic made me remember that, again, the rest of the world exists, and actually the rest of the world is quite nice. I have hobbies now, which is delightful. I didn't really used to have hobbies. My hobbies were just the pub and also gossiping, you know.
Right, yeah.
So it's a weird, there's very much in and out, and it's a weird world.
Well, brilliant. We'll definitely come back to that. But Marie, we're going to turn to the subject of the podcast. I've asked you to pick the 5 video games you want to put on your perfect video game console. Yeah, just tell me about your first game then, which comes from the early 2000s. What's this and why do you love it?
Soul Calibur 2. I must have played like 1 million hours of it with my brother and my stepbrother when we were kids. I think it's just, I kind of picked it because it's the main game. Like, if I think of, you know, what did we play? And actually, we played tons of stuff for some reason. That is the one game, I think, that we became obsessed with. That in a way that a group of kids will, I think, specifically.
Yes.
And I still, you know, and I can still look at screen grabs from the game and certain characters, and I get this very like visceral reaction from certain, you know, from some of them where I'm like, oh no, fuck you. Like, you know, I'll just see someone and that's a character I've not seen on my screen in like nearly 20 years. And I'm like, no, not you, go away. I can't remember her name now, actually, but so one of my favorite characters, the woman who was quite short and like quite, and I think like that's all most of the video games I play, which is maybe quite gendered, that's quite interesting, but I do quite like the characters who are quite, you know, light on their feet and not necessarily super powerful, but you get to move really quickly. But so it was that one woman who's really short.
Is it Sophia?
So the one, because I remember her tagline was "Wind guide me."
Okay.
Her, which is weirdly still like that floats into my head. I would say at least once a month.
Right.
Still, which is really odd. So really randomly ended up living with a friend for a couple of months in 2012. Who had a big telly and who had a console, and he happened to have Soul Calibur 2. And I do remember having some friends over, and actually retrospectively was a really weird night where, because I really enjoy hosting friends and organizing house parties and stuff. And I guess my specialty is just organizing currently random themed nights. So I think one themed night I had was straight whiskey and Soul Calibur 2. And that was it. And it's like, come to my house if you would like, you can only drink whiskey and we can only play Soul Calibur 2. So yeah, for some reason, that's one of the nights I organized. and we got sort of like riotously drunk and played that. And it was, you know, which is delightful. Like, it was exactly as fun as I'd remembered it.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, that's my my main game of probably like my first phase of gaming, I suppose.
Yeah. So you were playing that on, was it PlayStation 2? Is that right?
It was. Yeah, correct.
And you said you mentioned your brother and your stepbrother. So was that the first console that you got in your household in Nantes in France?
So that it was actually, God, like this feels like a really sort of hammy sitcom about reunited families or however you call them. Because I think, no, so my brother and I had a GameCube, but my stepbrother had a PlayStation 2. And so like when my dad and my stepmom got together, we became a two console household. but which is weird. Again, clearly that you asked me that. And yeah, that's not something I'd thought about in, yeah, again, well over a decade. But weirdly, like straight away, I was like, no, oh God, PlayStation 2 was not our side of the family, darling. Like we were a GameCube family, but then we married into a PlayStation household.
Diversified your portfolio.
Exactly.
So your parents, when they were together or when they were apart, how did they feel about you playing games? Were they up for it, or was it seen as a bit of a waste of time?
My dad is a mega nerd, but like mega nerd. I have, because I was born in 91, and there are pictures of me playing my first computer game. I can't have been much older than 3, like maybe 4. No, hang on. I'm lying. You know, so I think I was 4. So my first picture of me like playing a computer game was from 1995. So that's early.
Yeah.
And his thing, and I remember it like, from being a kid when my parents were still together, was, so he loved flight simulator games and even had like the special joystick thingy to play his, that. So yeah, that mid-90s, that was his thing. And by, what was it? I want to say by 2001, in my dad's place, we had more computers than people. So again, I very much grew up in an insanely sort of like geeky, nerdy house, household. So there were never... I feel like there were never any concerns on that front. So I knew that my brother, when he was a teenager, ended up having a phase, which I think a lot of boys did, to be fair, of his generation, of kind of just playing World of Warcraft all the time. But like literally all that, I think, as far as I can tell, he didn't really sleep or eat. He just played World of Warcraft. And I think that my parents did go a bit like, that is a lot of time, like a lot of time you're spending. And to be fair, like now, you know, he no longer does. And we had a chat about it and he's like, yeah, looking back, I did play a lot of Warcraft, and we were like, yeah, you really did. We were actually quite concerned for a while. But no, apart from that, it was that it's, yeah, very, very tech-friendly house.
Yeah.
So all fine on that front.
And did you want to be a writer at that time? Were you sort of, had your sights on political journalism or any kinds of journalism?
Definitely not political journalism. So I actually have quite a fun origin story, which is that when I was about seven, I only vaguely remember that, but it's been told to me again throughout the years. But yeah, I was about seven and I went to see my grandmother, who I'm very close to, and I was like, when I grow up, I want to be a poet. I want to write poetry. And my grandmother, who's this wonderful woman, but also, you know, it's quite forthright, let's say. And again, I was seven and she was like, no, you'll make no money from this. There's no money in poetry. Become a journalist instead, because then you can write and still make money. And in that way that, you know, seven-year-olds kind of take what they're given, I was like, yeah, seems fair. Cool, I'll do that. And then, yeah, that's the long story short. So then when I was 12, so in France, in college, you have to do a one-week bit of work experience somewhere as part of school. And yeah, this, yeah, really luckily, our next-door neighbours happened to be, like, the husband was a journalist at West France, which is actually the, I believe, still the most read newspaper in France. But a kind of local paper for Western France. And yeah, and so my dad asked him if I could just sort of like tag along to the newsroom for a week. And he said yes. And I did that. I still remember it. It was really cool. She was really fun. Like they, because I was just, yeah, a random child. But I went to do like a bit of quote unquote court reporting. So I spent a day in court.
No way, right.
I went to a press conference with the mayor of Nantes, who later became prime minister. So that was quite funny. They just threw me with a sort of like a reporter and it was like, okay, you're going to just like follow them on their beat for the day. So I did that for 5 days, which again, looking back, I'm like, that is quite weird, but it was super fun. And yeah, and that kind of confirmed that I wanted to write and I wanted to be a journalist. So when I was 12, actually, so at the same time, I started a blog, like just a kind of personal blog, writing about what happened at school and whatever. Then when I was 13, I got really into indie music. So I thought that I would turn my personal blog into a bit of a music blog. Then when I was 15, I very much had, so I think like teenagers have kind of like two modes of being. So either like complete and utter self-loathing, or they have the confidence of a god. And I feel like I fell into the latter camp. And to be fair to me, I was quite good with it. I identified a gap in the market and I filled it because I really loved, so that was the kind of like mid-2000s. I really loved indie music that was, you know, overwhelmingly British. And I knew that lots of people did as well in France, but actually the mainstream French music press was not very good at, you know, doing stuff like the NME was doing, all the like quite fun, new, exciting websites were doing in Britain. So I thought, cool, I'll just launch my own website. Which again, confidence of a god. So yeah, so I did that and basically it ended up working really well. So yeah, by the end, this sounds insane now I say it out loud looking back. But yeah, so when I was 17, I was busy running this team of writers across all like France, and I had people in Belgium and Switzerland.
No way.
And I'd send them to gigs to review them. So I was working quite closely with recording labels. They'd send me all their releases every month, which I'd review. We did lots of band interviews and stuff like that. But also, you know, got to interview lots of really famous bands because there were not, you know, because again, in France, no one really wanted to interview them. So I could just be like, dear Bloc Party, or like, dear Maximo Park, dear Franz Ferdinand, might I please, like, you know, I am a child.
I am the French music press.
No, but basically that. Yeah. But yeah, so that was really fun. And again, looking back, I'm like, some of these names, like, why did they agree? Like, why? It's like, hello, I'm an unhinged 16-year-old. Can I please drink a bottle of wine and then go ask you 7 questions? And they were like, yeah, fine.
That's incredible.
We also did that. It was really fun. It was so fun. I sort of have no regrets. I mean, you will be shocked and surprised to hear that I got absolutely appalling grades at my baccalaureat when I was 17, because I did not study at all in those years.
You've been hanging out with all the bands.
In my defense, right? And actually, that was a lot more fun. And I feel like it was exactly just as useful as you know, studying and being at school.
Yeah. Incredible.
The stamina, though, of teenagers, because there were nights where I'd literally go out till sort of like 5 a.m., sleep for an hour, and then go to school. And it's like, I would die now. Like, I would literally physically die.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then I went to uni to study journalism. So I moved to London. And the rest is kind of history. So it's been a weirdly straight line.
Yeah, incredible. It really shows the power of like the right work experience at the right time. Just with the effect that can have on you. It's like, if you'd have been paired, like done your work experience with a French poet, it would have been a very different experience. Staring out of windows. All right, we better come to your second game, Marie. So this is from 2013. So I'm guessing this is after the period of life you've been talking about. But tell us about this game. What was going on when you encountered it?
Oh, it's Rayman Legends. So that is actually that was the game I bought, my Christmas present from me to me, because I'd not played video games at all apart from that one evening of Soul Calibur for over a decade. And I had no idea if I was going to enjoy them or not. And B, I had no idea how much the landscape had changed, because I could see people, you know, playing stuff like Red Dead Redemption, and I'd heard all of these games, and I was like, that feels just way too overwhelming. I just remember being a little guy who jumps or a little guy who fights. And yeah, and I used to love Rayman, not just because it's made by French developers, but also I think, you know, like the games were really fun. But no, so yeah, Rayman Legends. So yeah, bought it. And yeah, and I loved it, but I became, I would say, quite obsessed. And it's, so I think what I really love about the game is that it's very straightforward. Like, it is basically just a platformer. Like, there's no meaningful story at all. You just have levels and you do stuff. And it's, you know, in some ways riffing on the early on sort of like Rayman games, but in others actually kind of innovating a fair bit. But basically, it's just like the execution is perfect. So I like, for, you know, for a start, like, the music is incredible. So like, the soundtrack is really, really like well made and well done.
Yes.
And you know, in some of the special levels as well, you actually have to play in rhythm with the music, which is really fun and really challenging. Basically, when I think about it, I'm like, there is no way. If you gave me a magic wand and said, okay, actually, you can be, you know, thrown into the room of devs working on that game and you can make them change anything you want.
Yeah.
I could not come up with anything. Like, it's a very straightforward game, but just done to perfection. And also, yeah, I feel really thankful for it because again, that maybe that there's a world in which I'd started with a different game and thought, actually, you know what, that was worth a shot. But turns out video games are like not my thing as an adult. Yeah. And that would have been the end of that. I'm actually like, it holds a special place in my heart.
Did you know it was French when you picked it up on that Christmas Eve?
I feel like I did. Yeah, but I think because again, so I did play the Rayman games when I was a kid. So right, I feel like I do. I do remember them being like, yes, this is our people's good, honest French games.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so you say that you were saying how you came to Westminster to study journalism there. At that plan was, did you want to graduate from there and go into music journalism? Is that what the sort of plan was with your experience?
Oh, it absolutely was. Yeah. And like, to the extent that, I can't remember what it was. I want to say maybe Southampton University or like somewhere offered a music journalism degree, which I considered doing. But then my parents were like, come on, like obviously not, obviously don't do that, that's insane, which is fair. You know, I think they were right. I'm happy to admit that when they're right, they're right. So yeah, so I kind of just went to study journalism, and I'm not sure, yes, I think I definitely did want to do music journalism, but also I think I was aware of the fact that life is long and you never quite know where you may end up. I've got ADHD, which I didn't know at the time, but obviously I know now, but I've always been a sort of a very passionate person, but I'm slightly like, I just throw myself all in. So I find a new interest and I just throw myself, like my entire being, into a thing until one day I get bored of it and then I find something else.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, and again, even though I'd not had that formal diagnosis yet, I already had a sense of who I was as a person, I think. So I already kind of knew that, you know, I was like, you know, for now, music is just my life, like my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows, you know, something will come along. And actually, so I think weirdly moving here was what made me move away from music, because in a way I had it quite easy and not, because, you know, because there was not a music press that was super developed, and especially the kind of like indie guitar-y music scene. Also because, you know, it was the right time. Like, it was the time when blogs were still quite new and fresh, yeah. And people found them exciting. And again, you could just email some random tour manager to be like, hello, can I please talk to your band? And they were like, I don't really see why not, sure. That was quite a special, I think, era, like moment in time.
Yeah.
The problem is I moved here and suddenly, you know, I became a very, very small fish in like the largest pond in the world, back when, you know, when I'd been an unexpectedly big fish in a tiny little pond. And that sucked. I did not enjoy that.
Yeah.
It's not fun to be a little fish. And it also suddenly, like, I couldn't. So I did blag my way into a couple of gigs when I first arrived. But that was that was mostly because I moved at 17, and obviously lots of gigs here are 18 plus. And so my thing was, which again, kind of a big balls move in retrospect, but I was like, okay, what is the way to ensure I'm not going to get ID'd? And it's like, ha, if I get a VIP pass, it seems unlikely they'll ID me on top of it. So literally, like, basically, I just worked really hard to interview random bands to get in so I didn't have to buy a normal ticket, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be able to go to the gig.
Yeah, genius.
So yeah. It worked.
And then what took you then into the world of politics? Because that's also a, you know, highly competitive area in the UK for media.
So that's a really random story. It's a really random story. First year in Britain, I'm still kind of into music. I still, you know, like, go watch a couple of bands playing. So I try to keep an eye on new bands, etc. Befriend some people. And then, yeah, so literally later that year, so the 2010 election happened to be on the last day of my first year of university, and some like small London band was playing in a pub, and I kind of knew the guitar player and I quite fancied him. So I was like, obviously I'm going to go to that gig. And I sort of like dragged some friends along, and we got incredibly drunk because obviously like end of the first year of uni. And then so yeah, that guitar guy, he was an acquaintance, kind of afterwards came to see me, and he was like, hey, so we're going to have like a small after party at my house. Do you want to come?
Yes.
And I was like, oh, well, obviously. Oh my God. I have never wanted anything more in my entire life. And yeah, and then my friends were a bit like, okay, well, you know, you're clearly going to get off with that guy, so we'll leave you be and we'll kind of go home. And I was like, yeah, fine, whatever. So we all, you know, this kind of group of people, we go back to that guy's house. But then disaster strikes in the form of him chatting up another woman who is not me, and them spending the evening together. And I was like, ah, that was not the plan. And then, you know, and I had that moment, like, really. So, you know, when you occasionally, like, when you're really drunk, you become very clear-eyed for about a split second, like, just really conscious of everything. And I was like, oh, because I was 18 and like, I think all that crowd were in their kind of like late 20s. I didn't know anyone there. I didn't have a smartphone at the time. So, you know, you couldn't just pop out Google Maps to see how to get home and what buses to take. It was probably like 2 a.m. And yet, obviously, I didn't have cab money because who has cab money at 18? And I didn't even know where I was in London. So I was like, OK, I am stuck here until the first tubes and I don't know anyone. And I noticed that the telly was on in the kind of like the back of the living room. And I was like, you know what? Fine, I'll go. Because I was like, oh, yeah, God, you know, there's the election tonight. And I'd not really been following, like, you know, I kind of knew the names of the leaders and stuff. But that's probably generally my level. And yeah, so I just grabbed another bottle of wine and then I went to sit by the telly and I watched the election unfold. And actually, I had such a good time. Like, I had, honestly, I had a blast. Because again, you know, I do have, yeah, like, I'm a very enthusiastic person. So I kind of became the, like, political correspondent of the House party. So I had no idea what I was talking about, but I'd be like, oh, well, you know, Somerset, whatever, has gone conservative. And everyone was like, okay, just sure. And, you know, and obviously there was a hung parliament at 2 a.m. I did not know what that meant. By 4 a.m., people would be like, what's going on? And I was like, well, so you see, there's this thing called a hung parliament. but yeah, so I watched it. Because I remember, yes, I left the house when it was entirely light outside. So it must have been really late. Mm. And yeah, and that is like hand on heart, honest to God, how I got into British politics. I tried to get laid and failed.
You're like, I'm so done with indie band guitarists. I'm moving on to the world of politics.
Oh yeah, and then it's great as well because the joke writes itself. Like, you know, I just got really, really tired of writing about like posh, obnoxious white men. So instead I went into politics.
Amazing. Right, okay, Marie, we better come to your third game then. So this, we have talked about this a little bit already right at the start, but this is from 2017. Tell us about this particular Zelda.
Oh God, the best game of all time. Breath of the Wild. So weirdly, I did not want to play Breath of the Wild at first because, yeah, so I was thinking, you know, lockdown, winter lockdown, Rayman Legends. And then I kind of did all the classics after that. So I did, you know, all your Marios, Luigi Mansion 3, which I will say is tremendous fun, by the way. I nearly picked it for this. It is, again, kind of similar to Rayman, where very straightforward, but also, is there anything you could have done better? No, it's just a perfectly formed game. But yes, yeah, so I yeah, played all the classics. And yeah, all my friends kept being like, you have to buy Breath of the Wild, you have to buy Breath of the Wild. And yeah, so I think I didn't want to buy it because it was or is still like £70, which is so much money. Like that's because I think that there's a weird mental thing because a lot of the games are around the £40 mark. And I think there's something after 50 where you're like, but that is just so much money. And what if I don't like it? So actually, what ended up happening was like some friends who'd already played it were like, listen, do you want to borrow it? Like, do you want to borrow it? Because they bought the physical copy of it. Like, do you want to borrow it? Is that fine? And I mean, you know, I was just entirely blown away by it, but I could probably spend the rest of the day talking about Breath of the Wild. Like, it was unlike any other game I've played. And also, I think in a weird way, I feel really thankful that I got to play it during lockdown because it nearly... So, Nick, because, you know, there's been so much talk recently about the metaverse and stuff like that. And that nearly felt like that because I didn't have a life outside, you know, like a real life. So actually, you know, I got to live life in Hyrule. And also, and that's the thing which I always find really hard to explain because it's hard to put into words. But what I find really striking about Breath of the Wild, and again, like I'm sure lockdown had a part to play in that as well, is that when I think back to certain bits of that game, I can tell that my brain has stored those memories alongside real life memories, not video game memories. So if I'm like, oh yeah, that day I was on the mountain and, you know, and there was a sunset and then I found this thing or I, you know, went down or this thing happened, I can tell that my brain is retrieving that from the real memories bit of storage, not the, no, that was a game bit. That, which is, yeah, such a testament to like how engrossing I think the game is. And it's also because I was still relatively new to proper gaming by then. And I did, which I'm sure, you know, is something lots of people did, of I just went head on and then I kept trying to fight every enemy I saw. And I died and died and died and died and died. And I'm slightly ashamed to say it took me so long to learn the lesson, because the game tries really hard to be like, listen, you have to be patient and either, you know, hide, maybe fire some arrows from a distance or throw some rocks from a distance or hide. And I was like, no,
charging
I run and I kill. Yeah. But dying 7 times in a row. And I was like, luckily, I do not learn from my mistakes. We go again. So that took me a long time. But also I think the fact that there's no order, because every other game I'd played had been very much like, you do X and then you do Y and then you do Z. And that took me a long time, because the game, like the beginning, I think Breath of the Wild, that there is a bit of hand holding, but there's really not that much. And I kind of struggled with that. But yeah, once I got really into it, it's even hard to talk about. But yeah, I just really, really loved it. It's a really beautiful game. But also, so what I will say, and what I think I've not seen tons in kind of writing about Breath of the Wild, is that I think one of the things that makes it especially impressive is that it's not that hard. So at the beginning, it is very hard because you've got no health, you've got no energy, like no stamina, your weapons are terrible, your defense stuff is terrible, etc. But like, you reach a plateau, I would say, reasonably quickly, especially given how long the game is, if you want to do it properly, like reasonably quickly, about what, 10, 20% of the way in, you kind of reach that thing, you've got good armor, you've got good weapons, you've got good health, good stamina. And at that point, the game actually becomes quite easy, because, you know, we've all played games before where you're like, oh my God, that boss fight, you know, I had to do 17 times before I managed it. And actually quite quickly with Breath of the Wild, I did not find that at all. I could sort of kill most things or most bosses or do most things without dying relentlessly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I find it quite incredible they managed to make, you know, to make a game that is still really engaging and compelling and interesting, despite not being that hard, if that makes sense. Because normally, like, I do think that quite a lot of games rely maybe a bit too heavily on making stuff really hard so people play for a long time and feel like they're more invested. You know, I think Hollow Knight being quite a classic example of the genre. It was like, did I enjoy Hollow Knight, or was it just Stockholm Syndrome from having to fight the same fucking boss 1 million times because I kept getting shanked?
Right, yeah.
And yeah, so I think the fact that it was not hard, again, yeah, like played into that thing of saying, actually, this is just a different world. I'm just living this kind of different life. So no, it was an absolute game changer. And then I played it again. So I played it for the first time and I played, so I think about 150 hours. So I downloaded the DLC and I did all that. Then I gave the cartridge back to my friends. And then, so I went to Venice for 2 months last year. And I knew, because I knew I had some friends in Venice, but not that many. And obviously Venice is not as busy as London, which is one of the reasons why I went. But I thought, you know, I'm going to have some free time.
Yeah.
So yes, I played it again. And I think that second run, again, just out from a completely fresh file, was about 100 hours.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it was, wow. It was great. And I didn't really tire of it.
Yeah.
So yes, no, just again, kind of running out of words to describe how wonderful the game is.
It is wonderful. Yes, indeed. So you said right at the start, we were talking about the Westminster Village and how it can, you know, feel very villagey. But I think a lot of the people in that village, and this I'm including journalists in this as well, can sort of come from a similar background, right? It's normally a private school, perhaps then study philosophy, politics, economics at Oxford, and then into Westminster. And, you know, I suppose you're coming from quite a different point of view, you know, coming from France, but also from music journalism, all that. How did you have the confidence to sort of go up to people at these parties that you're going to and start talking to them?
Oh, that was just who I am as a person, I think. But no, more seriously, I think actually music journalism was really good training for that, because I had to interview. And actually, you know, when you think of, like, fine, you know, in theory, I guess that it is quite scary to go talk to, like, a Secretary of State or something. But then if you compare that to being 16 or 15 or 17 and having to hold your own in front of a singer or a guitarist or whatever who you absolutely love, you know, who's every song you know by heart, like, the latter is way scarier. Like, having done both, like, a million times each, the latter is, like, so much harder, because you just have to sit there and be like, oh, no, I'm a professional. Like, do I want to cry a little bit? Yeah, I do. Yeah, I kind of, you know, I could do a little cry, but no, I'm going to hold my own and I'm going to ask my questions and have a bit of banter, because, you know, that makes the interview better and stuff. So I think that was really good training. I think maybe the foreign thing as well is probably helped a bit at the beginning, because, again, that, you know, none of them were the kind of people I grew up with on telly and stuff. But then, so I wonder, because that's my thing, yeah, so my proper entry into journalism was at the Evening Standard Diary, which, so for people who don't know, so the diary column, which has mostly disappeared now, but it's kind of like halfway between a gossip column, I guess, from a gossip magazine and Private Eye. So a lot of it is not news by definition, but it's kind of...
Intrigue, isn't it?
It is, no, exactly, like mischief. And yeah, but the way it works internally is that you, so nearly all the stories we got from events. So you work there, and in the evening you were just sent to an event and your goal was just find a story. So I remember, like, the first shift I did at the Standard, and, you know, I was being sent to a book launch. So it's not just politics, kind of covering every area of kind of polite society. I sent to a book launch, and I asked my editor, I was like, okay, what do you want from this? She was like, well, you go to the book launch and you come back with a story.
That's such great training. Oh my gosh.
It is. And it's properly sink or swim. And, you know, and I went, and actually I didn't get a story printed in the paper the next day, but I did manage to talk to, like, a few of the actors who were there, because it's like the launch of a book, I think, written by some cinema person. And clearly she saw that I was able to talk to people. So I think that was actually really good training, because you are just sent to a room and you just have to basically, so people who are there, you need to, like, support their friends or talk to their friend, talk to their colleagues, make some friends, network. You have to get them away from the people they actually want to talk to. And then you have to ask them questions, which they don't really want to answer, but in a way that's playful enough that they'll answer them.
Right, right.
But on the other hand, you know, it is always events with free alcohol.
Yeah, which helps.
It does massively. You know, I did usually, because I was friends with the other diarists from the other newspapers, and we'd kind of all arrive as a pack, sort of have two glasses of wine, and then we'd get to work.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think, yeah, it's a mix of, you know, like, baptism of fire. And again, thinking back, so what was it? I must have been... like 20, I remember being 24 and, like, drinking champagne and chatting to Philip Hammond, who was then, was it like foreign secretary or defense secretary? And trying to, I can't remember, I actually got quite a good story out of him, I remember, because it was just before the referendum. And yeah, looking back, I'm like, huh, that weird life I had at 24.
Yeah, you've got to sort of get, you know, compound power, haven't you? Being a younger person, being French, so you're sort of coming from the outside, and then the modifier of alcohol can all help you get those stories. I mean,
it does.
In the UK, we have extremely robust, let's say, libel laws, and individual journalists can find themselves in court rather than the publication that published their reporting sometimes. How aware were you of that when you were, you know, writing this stuff, that... one wrong word in a gossip story could land you in a lot of trouble?
Actually, it was fine, because, and I think that's one of those things I can get a bit spiky about, where people assume that, you know, especially other journalists, I think there was a lot of snobbery against diarists and diary columnists. They were like, oh, but, you know, you just get sloshed and you write gossip, right? You know, you don't do proper journalism. It's actually, you know, I'd like to see you try, like, A, to get the stories, and B, again, you know, print them in a way that will not get you sued. But I mean, I think the slightly boring answer is that, yeah, we had, so Joy Lodico was my editor at the time, who's a brilliant, brilliant woman who I'd kind of trust with my life. So I think, A, having actually, like, a grown-up there who knew what she was doing massively helped. Having a robust legal department as well, I think, at the newspaper
helped.
But then I think there's a thing as well with gossip, and I think it's not just diaries, but you get that with a Pulp Bitch newsletter, you get that with Private Eye to an extent. You get that of a Private Eye, actually, especially for politicians, that, like, it is rarely a good idea to start a war with people who will want to win and who will want to have fun winning. So it's a bit like, yeah, trying to pick a fight with a toddler, and it's like, they don't have a job, they can be here all day. You know, don't do this.
Amazing. All right, let's come to your fourth game then, Marie. So this is from 2018. Tell us about this one.
I can't remember which one it was. Oh, Hades. After I finished Breath of the Wild, I basically went through a number of stages of grief. because, you know, because it was incredible. And also because I really struggled to find another game to replace it with, because it's so unique and so unlike every other game and so good that, you know, everything else I played was just really bad. Like, it kind of felt like, you know, kind of being dumped or like breaking up with someone who was like a great love of yours and then going on a bunch of first dates. So you're like, oh God, I'm going to be alone forever. Like, this is it for me now. So that lasted for a bit. And then I played Hades. And I think so. A, what helped, to be fair, is that it could not be more different, because it is a roguelike, roguelite rather, I suppose. Don't want to upset the nerds too much. It is a roguelite game. So, you know, but by definition, you just have to do the same thing again and again and again and again, which is exactly the opposite with Breath of the Wild, where you're just in this massive open world and you kind of do whatever you want. But no, I think so. So the story I found incredibly compelling in Hades, because you're, for people who haven't played it, so you kind of just wake up, you're thrown into the story, you wake up as Zagreus, son of Hades, you're in the, you're living in hell, and you want to leave hell, because actually you think your dad's a bully and you're not happy there, and you want to reach the surface, and you have to fight through worlds and different enemies and bosses to try and get to the surface, and every time you die, you start back at the beginning, but because, you know, you're immortal because you're the son of Hades, so that's fine, and that's kind of incorporated into the story, the fact that you die. But I think the mechanic, again, for people who haven't played, that makes it especially interesting is that the only way to get stronger is to die. Because I think, you know, like the roguelike and the roguelite, that's not a new video game format at all. But usually the plot is not influenced by how many times you die, I suppose. So, you know, like Dead Cells, for example, which I really loved as well. You just die and then you just keep going. Whereas, you know, Hades, the only way, so lots of lines of dialogue, the only way you can get to them is by dying and coming back to the underworld, to the bottom of the underworld. And talking to that person, then doing another run, dying and starting again. Like, that is literally the only way you can get the story. And the story, which is incredibly rich. But but no, and I got saved. So I think I did 120 hours on Hades.
I love how you've remembered all the hours that you put into each of them. It's great.
It's, yeah, my brain is a blessing and a curse. But no, so I, but yeah, so that's the game I very nearly did. I very nearly 100%ed it. Because it's got, and it's not really a spoiler, I think, because there's one ending, then there's a real ending, then there's a secret real ending. So yeah, got all three. And also, yeah, so I actually got to the point where I actually Googled all the different achievements you could get. And yeah, and I think I'd done nearly all of them. So the only ones I'd not done were all the like quite boring, you know, the stuff that's very grindy, which I couldn't be bothered doing. But in terms of the story side of it, I finished every single storyline with every single character. Like, I was done. Like, I scraped that game to the bone. Yeah. Like, it was done. And yeah, no, just, yeah. And also, again, because a lot of it is, because you do get, so you do have obviously all the Chthonic gods in the underworld, but you've got all the Olympians as well, who are kind of like trying to help you on your journey, to help you reach the surface and stuff. And as someone who learned a bit of Greek mythology at school, and just out of general interest when I was younger, it is really fun. Like, it is really fun to see all those characters and interact with them. I think sleep with some of them as well. Like, Zagreus is a bit of a slut in that game. And it's such a, yeah, it's such a weird, such a weird thing to be like, oh, hey, it's you. Like, but you know, by you, I mean like an ancient Greek god, my close personal friend.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, brilliant. And I can't wait to see the second one is coming out. I don't think we have a release date yet, but we've had the first trailer and I cannot wait.
Yeah,
cannot
wait. It's going to be good, definitely. So your book, let's talk about your book from last year, Escape, How a Generation Shaped, Destroyed and Survived the Internet. You write about being, I suppose, in that first part of the first generation to grow up with the internet, which I think I just about also qualify for, perhaps. And, you know, what do you miss about those early years of being on the internet? What do you think we've lost?
Oh, God, I miss so much. Really randomly, I did a panel a couple of days ago on video games and the future of gaming and stuff. And I was on that panel with people who deal a lot in metaverse-y stuff, blockchain, NFTs.
You're on a panel with charlatans, you mean? Sorry.
I could not possibly comment, obviously, at this stage. But what I found, you know, and it was one of those actually why I'd not even, and I'm happy to admit that I'd not done a ton of prep, because again, I was like, I feel like I know what I want to say, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's fine. But actually what I found, you know, because occasionally I think you end up building arguments in your head by saying them. And then that kind of happened with that where, you know, because they were like, oh, but, you know, think about, you know, the future of gaming where you're able to earn money by playing, you're able to kind of, you know, like gain these assets and stuff. And I sort of slightly snapped and I was like, but why can't gaming just be its own thing? You know, why can't you just Oh good, I can't remember the phrasing now. Playing for its own
Yeah.
Complete brain fart.
Why can't you just play for its own sake? Yeah. But you have to capitalize on it.
No, exactly. What can't gaming just be its own thing and that for its own, yeah. And then that made me think, because there was actually so much of the internet used to be that. So, you know, blogging, and again, even my you know, music website, I did it because I loved it. And obviously I got some free albums and I got some free gig tickets out of it, but that's all I got. You know, I never got a cent. Like in all those years and hours I poured into that, I just got to have a really fun time. And I think so much of the internet was doing stuff for their own sake and because you wanted to have a good time. And actually so much of it is just not about that anymore. And actually I think gaming is, you know, is still like a rare oasis where it's very straightforward. You pay money to buy a game and then you play the game and you have a good time. But yeah, so I would say that that's kind of probably the overarching sort of narrative, like in terms of what I miss. I miss just having fun for the sake of it, doing stuff for the sake of them. Right, so yeah. Be that again, yeah. Writing.
Not being monetized all
no,
the
exactly,
time.
No, exactly. And not, you know, and not thinking, oh, you know, yeah, if this does well, I could become an influencer or I could get free stuff from that brand or I could get a profile or I could, et cetera. You know, like I just really enjoyed that kind of, what I suppose in retrospect was kind of an age of innocence, right? Of just saying, hey, you know, I've got this sandbox, this sandpit, and I'm just going to play in it and kind of see what happens. And I think that is, you know, and I could kind of go more granular and talk about, you know, the million things I miss from the earlier days of the internet. But I think that is very much the thing that connects a lot of them. It was really good to be able to do stuff for their own sake.
Yeah, yeah. What was the main website you were hanging out on?
But that's the thing. Again, there was not, because everything is so much more decentralized. There was no single website. Well, I guess that MySpace changed that. But before that, you know, I just had blogs. And that's kind of how I described them in the book, actually, in Escape, where So I think, yeah, I nearly used to think of all the blogs I read as a bus route. So every day I would come home from school and I would be like, okay, so now, you know, I check this blog and then I check that blog to see which ones had updated, because I didn't use the Google Reader stuff. So it was just manually. I was like, okay. And I did them all in the same order every single time. So actually, yeah. So again, that's the crucial point of there was no one massive website. There was just blogs. And, you know, and I would look, there's a blog I really liked, because see, every blog had the sidebar with that blogs they'd recommend. And occasionally I'd be like, okay, I could do with some new blogs. And then, you know, you'd check them out. And then if you liked one, you added them to your bus route.
Yeah.
And then I think there was better times.
They were better times, definitely. All right, Mary, we better come to your fifth and your final game, which is from 2019. Do you want to tell us about this one?
Oh, God, Slay the Spire. I actually checked, and I know how much you enjoy me telling you exactly how many hours I put into every single game. So I did check out of curiosity the other day, and I have played Slay the Spire for 200 hours, which is so low. But it's so weird. So I think I bought it. So I'd actually had a bit of a rotten run of buying, but I think quite a few, luckily most of them were quite indie games, so none of them were incredibly expensive. But I bought like a good sort of like three or four games and played a couple of hours and was like, no, actually, I'm just not enjoying this, or it's too hard for me and not my kind of game, blah, blah, blah. So I was really annoyed. Because again, it does, even if it's games, you know, even if it's not like 50 quid games, it still adds up quite quickly. And, you know, I was a bit annoyed. And I think, I can't remember who I was talking to. I was like, when you Slay the Spire, super cheap. And it's really just it's just kind of a card game. And I sort of bought it originally. This is quite funny in retrospect, obviously. I bought it as a sort of, okay, I can just play this random card game until I find something else I want to play. Joke's on me. I played it for 7 months and I still cannot really stop playing it.
Yeah.
But no, so I think, yeah, for people who haven't played, it is kind of like a card game. So it is roguelike, I suppose, in a way as well, in that you are trying to escape from this dungeon and you've got hallway fights with normal enemies and you've got bosses and so like different, like three different worlds, I suppose. But yeah, you play with cards. So, you know, some cards are like attacks, some are defense, some are like special powers. And you can get potions and you can get relics, etc. But at its heart, it is a card game. And I think as a result, you never get tired of it. It just in the same way that people can just play the same card games throughout their lives. I think that's quite a similar thing of actually you never quite get bored of card games, but also because
it has
that
wonderful like daily leaderboard as well, the daily challenge, so you can go back every day and see how you compare against everyone else in the world, which is Such a simple idea, but it's so brilliant, isn't it?
It is. Well, I try not to shake the leaderboards because I'm quite competitive and I'm obviously just like, and on a global scale, I'm just not very good at Slay the Spire. But it's also, so I think what I like about it is that it keeps you on your toes, because I think any game, even Hades by the end, one of the reasons I stopped playing was that I'd got really, really good at it, because, you know, you have to fight and learn how to fight and stuff, and I was really good at the fighting. We'll say the Spire, and you can even watch. So I watch a lot of videos of people playing, because actually it's quite a fun game to watch.
Yeah.
And even people who've poured like hundreds and hundreds, probably over 1,000 hours into it, sometimes you'll just get really, you know, unlucky and you keep drawing the wrong cards, or you keep, you know, you have a really bad deck or whatever happens, or you draw your cards in the wrong order and you just die. And there's nothing you can do about it. You just die. But again, just like in any game of cards, there's obviously a level of skill, but ultimately it's kind of down to chance. And so that's definitely kept me going back for more.
Yes, and then
it's very unique as well, I would say, in terms of, yeah, format. But yeah, no, again, so I think I picked that one because, again, I played myself quite beautifully by going, I can just buy this and play it for a couple of weeks until, you know, I find a real game to play. 7 months. 7 months.
It is a time sink and a wonderful game. Right, Marie, let's look at your console. So we've got Soul Calibur 2, Rayman Legends, Breath of the Wild, Hades and Slay the Spire. Some classic games there. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, no, I'm feeling really good about that. Actually, I think if we ever had to have another lockdown, which I really, really hope to God we don't. If I had those five, like I could, you know, I could survive. If I could, so even better, if I could somehow get my mind wiped, again, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, yeah, except with video games, then I would have a great time. Like, you would not see me again. The lockdown would end and I'd still be at home.
You have a good 700 hours or so of content there to get through. Okay, we need to give you a console a name so that we can market it to the world. Have you got an idea for what we could call this?
Oh, I didn't know I had to prepare a name. You've put me on the spot. Oh my god, what are we calling it? I have no idea. What have other people said in the past?
Well, we get a lot of after the GameCube, actually, we get a lot of, like, you know, Phil Wang said the Wang Cube, for example, and then a lot of people like to put in numbers as well, so the something something 5000. I don't know why that happens, because that doesn't really happen in video game console namings. But
can I nick that idea and call mine like the ML Cube or something?
Yeah, the ML Cube. Oh yeah, because that's your sort of online handle, isn't it? MLC.
Yeah, MLC. So yeah, ML Cube.
ML Cube. Very nice. That's perfect. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much. Just before I let you go, I wanted to ask. So, you know, obviously, you told us your amazing story about how you got into journalism and your route. I don't know how instructive that's going to be for a young person who might be thinking of following in your footsteps. You know, what would you say is a good way into that world? And also, do you think it's a worthwhile pursuit, you know, political journalism?
Ooh, well, I think political journalism drives me insane on a weekly basis, but also I really enjoy it more than I think other things I would be doing. But no, I think, so in journalism in general, and I think that probably applies to definitely not every industry, but a number of them. So I'm going to give advice, which I don't remember telling my friend, but who apparently remembered it for years and has been using it as his guiding light since I told him. And I was like, I have no memory of ever telling you that, but I'm really happy that's helped you along your journey. But at some point he said, he was like, I think the point I was trying to make was saying that networking is just really useful. And he said, he was like, oh yeah, you once told me, no matter how boring a conversation is with some random person over a warm glass of like wine at some like pub gathering or some event, it's never going to be as boring as having to fill in a massive job application because you can't get an interview through other channels. It's like, God, that is actually such a wanky piece of advice, but also entirely correct. It is entirely correct. But even, yeah, I think, you know, because I don't want to sound like a sort of like LinkedIn post come to life, but
yeah.
I don't, to be clear, it's not like I've never done that. And again, it's all like slightly like devious, like specifically I'm trying to network so I can get jobs way. But it's more, I think it always helps to just meet as many people as you can and have as many chats as you can. And also kind of, yeah, give everyone the time of day, and you never know what it'll lead, right? And and even, and I don't know, maybe that's a French Moroccan thing as well, but I do talk to everyone all the time. Like a friend recently was like, I can't remember, yeah, something, she made fun of me, and the punchline of her thing was saying, you know, RIP Marie, she died as she lived, talking to strangers for some reason. And I was like, oh God, yeah, I suppose that's the thing I do a lot. So yeah, just talk to everyone.
Yeah.
I think that's just good life advice in general.
Yeah, certainly for a writer or a journalist, you've got to be interested in people, I think, otherwise Otherwise, you're not going to get very far, are you?
But also otherwise, why are you there? If you're not curious about the world and about the people who live in it, why would you want to become a writer?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. I was worried that last bit of advice was going to be monstrous, Marie, but you turned it around quite nicely. This has been great. Thank you so much for doing it and for telling. I loved hearing you talk about your choices and your story. So thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to my guest, Marie Leconte, the political journalist and freelance journalist extraordinaire. And what a wonderful story of how a childhood love of video games that was put down in adolescence, perhaps, was then picked up again. And Marie was able to find in video games a bit of refuge, a bit of purpose, and a bit of community as well. And now she is off speaking about her love of video games on the BBC and in all these other places. It's wonderful. If you're interested in reading some of her work that she does away from video games, then you can follow her on Twitter at Young Vulgarian. That's V-U-L-G-A-R-I-A-N. And you will be able to see what Marie's up to. She's also got a Tumblr at marieleconte.tumblr.com. Old school, I love it. On both of those places, you'll be able to catch up on the things that she's writing and read her columns in The Guardian, The New Statesman, all over the place. You'll be able to find what she's up to. Yeah, that was great. Really, really lovely choices as well. Soul Calibur 2. Haven't had that before on the podcast, but very, very glad to see it. The Soul Calibur character that Marie was searching for the name for is, of course, Talim. Talim, I'm sure some of you were screaming at whatever device you listened to this on. Apologies for that. And of course, I suggested the character Sophia, who isn't a character in Soul Calibur. I was, of course, thinking of Sophita. It's been a little while since I played that game. I'm playing Street Fighter 6, so, you know, got all of those new names in my head. You can forgive me that. Thank you, as ever, for listening this far into the podcast. You can follow along with the podcast on Twitter at MyPerfectConsole with the O's removed. Also on Instagram with the O's still in place. But rather excitingly, as I think you will have heard from the ad that I ran before this episode, we launched a Patreon today. So lots of exciting things that you can get involved in there by becoming a supporter. You'll get information on the guests that are coming up long before other people. You'll have your opportunity to even pitch some questions to those guests that will be made available in bonus episodes. And you'll get voting rights to vote in the My Perfect Console knockout competition to crown the console of the year. Maybe I'll even try and get the winner of that back on for a special episode, and lots of other great stuff. It's also a good way to just support the podcast, help make it a bit more sustainable and keep it going. Really enjoying this. You seem to be too. Have lots of lovely messages from you readers. So come along to Patreon and get involved. We'll see how it goes. I've never run one of these before, so I'm not entirely sure how it's all going to go, but we'll figure it out as we go along and it'll be a good ride, I'm sure. If you do want to write to me with any thoughts or feedback or guest suggestions, then you can now do so in the chat room on the My Perfect Console Patreon. That's at patreon.com/MyPerfectConsole. Or you can just email me. That's at MyPerfectConsole@gmail.com. If you get a spare moment, leave us a review, leave us a star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or something like that. It does help other people to find the podcast. Got some really exciting guests coming up, lads. Really some good chats in the bag. That is from, you know, game developers, both in the independent space, also in the blockbuster space. We've got some comedians coming up. We've got some fantastic novelists. We've got an academic who has some really interesting views on video games that I'm excited to share with you, a comic book writer, just some of the people we've got coming up, voice actors as well. I like speaking to voice actors. Anyway, you'll be able to see who some of those people are if you're interested on the Patreon. I'll stop banging on about it now. Thank you again for listening. I'll be back again next week with one more guest, their five games, and another perfect console. Until then, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.